Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Good afternoon, everybody. Today I seem to have a horse in my throat. Okay, we have been discussing this poem from the Sutta Nipata called The Serpent, the Uruga Sutta. And this is a poem which deals with the reflections or contemplations of a monk who is intent on winning the ultimate liberation, what is called going beyond or giving up the here and the beyond. The here and the beyond refer to, at one level, we can say, the dualities of life, the discriminations of this and that, and ultimately they refer to the different realms of existence within samsara, within the round of rebirths. And so the here refers to life in this world, the human realm, and the beyond refers to existence or life in any realm, any state of existence beyond the human realm, whether it be the lower realms or even the higher realms, existence in the heavens, the divine realms. All of these realms of existence are finite, conditioned, limited. And so the ultimate attainment is the attainment of Nibbana, Nirvana, which is beyond the dualities of this world and the other world, the here and the beyond. And this poem compares the giving up of all of these dualities, giving up the here and the beyond, is compared to the process by which a serpent sheds its worn-out skin. And so just as a serpent, in order to come forth with its new skin, has to give up, leave behind the old, withered, worn-out skin, so if one is to go beyond to the ultimate realization, the attainment of the unconditioned, the deathless element, Nibbana, one has to give up all of these dualities, all of these attachments, whether the attachment to anything in this world or the attachment to anything in the beyond, anything in any other world. And to give up the attachments that tie us to this round of existence means to give up the different defilements and the different delusions. And so as the poem progresses from one verse to the next, we will find the speaker, the author, taking up a particular defilement or a particular delusion as the theme or topic for that particular verse. And usually that defilement will be connected with a particular simile or analogy. So last time I discussed only the first verse about giving up anger or wrath, which is compared to the venom of a snake that spreads very quickly and does a lot of damage. Okay, now we come to verse 2. He who entirely cuts off his lust this is raga, as entering a pond, one uproots lotus plants. Such a monk gives up the here and the beyond, just as a serpent sheds its worn-out skin. Okay, the defilement or the topic of this verse is raga or lust. And raga, lust, is very closely connected with tanha, craving. In fact, the two are sometimes used as synonyms. But in the next verse, we will see that craving is taken as the topic. So there must be some distinction between lust and craving here. The way I would see it is that here lust is referring specifically to the craving that is attached to the five objects of sensual pleasure. So this is sensual lust, sensual craving. And then the craving spoken of in verse 3 will be the craving for existence, bhava tanha. Okay, so the topic of verse 2, as I would understand it, is sensual lust. And we see this quite fittingly illustrated by the simile of a lotus plant or a lotus flower. The lotus flower, it's very beautiful flower. When it grows up in the pond, swampy pond, grows up from the mud, and it opens and it's very beautiful, many petals, very sweet smelling, attracts the bees. And so this is a fitting image or a symbol for the sense objects that awaken sensual desire. And now in the Buddha's teaching, in order to obtain ultimate liberation, it is necessary to overcome sensual desire. And one of the main forms of sensual desire, naturally, is sexual desire. And so I should speak a little bit about the Buddhist attitude towards sexual desire. Buddhism doesn't regard sexual desire as being in itself intrinsically bad or evil. It regards sexual desire as being just a natural desire. Sometimes this natural desire can overcome the bounds of morality, of decency. And so the Buddha has laid down certain principles or guidelines for his lay followers in order to help them keep sexual desire within the bounds of what is proper or righteous. And so the basic guideline is to avoid misconduct, wrong conduct in regard to sexual desire. That is to avoid adultery, seduction, or any other types of illicit sexual activity. But Buddhism regards sexual desire in any form as one of the most powerful types of craving or tanha. And therefore, for one who wants to progress towards ultimate liberation, it becomes necessary to weaken and to overcome sexual desire. But now people think when they hear about this that sexual desire is the source of pleasure and happiness. And so if one is going to give up sexual desire, then there won't be any pleasure or happiness in life. Okay, if this was the Buddha's teaching, then I would say, give it up. Throw out the Buddha's teaching and just enjoy the sexual pleasures. But even if the Buddha says there'll be liberation, but if we have to progress towards liberation following a very grim, dull, on pleasurable path, then there would be very little to attract us to the Buddha's teaching. But what one finds from practicing the Dhamma is that as one progresses along the path of practice, that one begins to enjoy a pleasure and a happiness that is deeper, more stable, and more beautiful than the pleasure that comes from indulging the sensual desire. More powerful than the pleasure that comes from sexual indulgence. When one develops the mind, especially in meditation, and when one is able to focus the mind and keep the mind steadily upon an object, then there starts to arise from deep within the mind the experience of piti, that's joy or rapture, and sukha, which is happiness, pleasure, or bliss. And these factors, as they come up, they become more and more powerful until they bring into the mind a real surge of radiant pleasure, radiant joy, which is at the same time very clean, very purifying. And so when experiences this pleasure, joy, rapture, then the pleasures of the senses just seem so unattractive, so disturbing, so distressing, that one loses interest in them. And then when one starts to develop insight and starts to see at a very deep level, a moment-to-moment level, microscopic level, into the arising and passing away of phenomena, as they go on moment by moment, then one experiences again a very deep joy and happiness. And so, in the practice of the Buddha's teaching, we use these higher types of happiness as a way to bring the mind away from the lower types of happiness. And even this happiness of concentration, happiness of insight, these are still parts of the path, still stages along the way, till one reaches the ultimate happiness, bodhi, sambodhi sukha, the happiness of enlightenment, or vimukti sukha, the happiness of liberation. And that is the happiness which is beyond all other types of happiness and pleasure. According to the commentary on the Sutta Nipata, this verse was spoken by the Buddha in a particular situation. And though sometimes one wonders whether one should believe all the stories that come in the commentaries, but it's interesting to hear them, to know them. According to the story, the Buddha's chief disciple, Venerable Sariputta, he was the disciple who was most distinguished in wisdom. He had a newly ordained monk sent to him for instructions in meditation. And this monk, newly ordained monk, came from a well-established family of goldsmiths. And the Buddha, Venerable Sariputta, saw this young monk who is maybe just 22, 23 years old and very healthy, radiant. And so Venerable Sariputta thought, a young monk like this must have a lot of trouble with sensual desire. And so I'll give him the chief meditation subject for overcoming sensual desire, that is the meditation on the unattractive nature of the body, that is meditating on the body is made up of skin, flesh, bones, blood, different internal organs. Okay, so Sariputta explained this meditation subject to the monk. The monk went off, practiced this meditation. Over and over, for several months, he kept on working at this meditation subject. But he couldn't achieve any success with it. So he came back again and again to Sariputta. Sariputta asked him, "How are you doing with your meditation?" The monk said, "I'm trying very hard, but nothing is happening." Okay, finally, Sariputta thought, "I'm not able to instruct this monk properly. Perhaps I should take him to see the master, the Buddha." And so they went together to the Buddha, and Sariputta explained the problem. And now the Buddha has the ability to look at a person, and just by looking at that person, to see that person's previous lives, many of his previous lives. And so when the Buddha looked at this young monk, he saw that in many past lives, the commentary says in 500 previous past lives, that monk had been a goldsmith. And so this meant that he had naturally an attraction to things that are fine and beautiful. And so the Buddha thought that giving him an unattractive meditation object is not the way to fit his mental disposition. And so instead, the Buddha took a different approach. The Buddha used his spiritual powers to create, they were standing on the bank of a lake, a pond, near a pond. The Buddha used his spiritual power to create a lotus flower in that pond. And then he asked that monk to stay by the pond and take that that lotus flower, red, golden red lotus flower, as his meditation object. Okay, so the monk would come to the pond every day and meditate on the lotus flower. And then, as he was meditating, the monk was able very quickly to get the nimitta, to get the sign, the meditation sign with the lotus flower. And so he became very ecstatic. He was able to develop the jhanas, the meditative absorptions, based on the lotus flower. He would just look at the lotus flower and his mind would immediately go into deep samadhi, deep concentration. Okay, so then when the Buddha knew that this monk had succeeded in developing concentration based on the lotus flower, then the Buddha used his spiritual power to make that lotus flower wither up and wilt and crumble up right in front of the monk's eyes. And so when the monk saw this, this was to him a revelation of the truth of impermanence, anicca. And by seeing this impermanence of the lotus flower, the monk came to realize that everything in this world is impermanent. Nothing is lasting. And just by getting that quick insight, he again applied that principle of impermanence to his own body, his own mind. He saw everything arising and falling away instantaneously. And as he was observing this, then insight after insight arose, and then he reached the stages of realization and attained arahantship. And when he achieved arahantship, then as a way of congratulating him, the Buddha came to him and spoke this verse, "One who entirely cuts off his lust, as entering a pond, one uproots lotus plants, such a monk gives up the here and the beyond, just as a serpent sheds its worn-out skin." Okay, so this is the verse on cutting off or giving up sensual desire, sensual lust. Okay, now we come to verse 3. "One who entirely cuts off his craving by drying up its fierce and rapid flow, such a monk gives up the here and the beyond, just as a serpent sheds its worn-out skin." Okay, this verse deals with the, as I said before, this verse explicitly it is dealing simply with craving. But since the previous verse is dealing with lust, we could take to be sensual craving, then verse 3 must be dealing with the craving for existence, what we call bhava tanha. This is the craving to be one thing or another, the craving to go on existing in one form or another. And according to the Buddha's teaching, this craving for existence is the most powerful force that keeps the cycle of rebirths turning. The verse compares this craving to a very strong and powerful river or stream, something which just goes on flowing. And in India, the image of a strong, powerful river would be something very vividly impressed on the Indian mind, because during the monsoon season, it rains very, very heavily. And when it rains during the monsoon season, then many little streams that are dried up during the rest of the year fill up with water. And when those streams fill up, then their water pours down into the larger streams. They carry their water down to the rivers. And then the big rivers swell up and go on flowing very swiftly, very strongly, sweeping away everything that comes in their path. And it is this image that gives some idea of the nature of this craving. This is the craving for existence that drives us on through beginningless time without any first point. No matter how far back we go back, we speak about the beginning of this particular world cycle. We call this universe, scientists say, 15 billion years ago, they speak about the Big Bang, brought this universe into being. What existed before that? They say that they don't know. But before that, there had to be another world system that was coming to an end. That came to an end. Before that, another world cycle came to an end. And before that, another world cycle. And we can go on back without finding any first point to that process. And during this entire time, who was there? Living beings. And who are those living beings? Ourselves. We were present through this whole process without any first point And what has kept us moving throughout this whole beginningless process is this craving for existence. And like this powerful river, it sweeps us on. Sometimes it takes us to the heavenly realms, and then we spend maybe thousands of years enjoying wonderful, the most ecstatic music, more beautiful than any music you ever hear on earth, eating or drinking the most delicious nectars, more delicious than anything one eats or drinks on earth, enjoying the most finest wearing the finest clothing, no work schedules, no slums there, no murders, no drug addiction there, no war. Well, actually, there are battles there. That's sort of the bad news in the heaven world. Battles between the devas and the asuras. But when life comes to an end there, then one falls away, takes rebirth elsewhere. And even after spending maybe lives and lives in lower realms, could even be in the hell realms, still that craving for existence arises, still strong, still powerful, pushing us on to new realms, to new experiences, new states. And to gain liberation, there is no other way but to end that craving for existence. And to end that craving for existence, the only way is to end the blindness, the ignorance that keeps that craving flowing. And by rightly contemplating the Dhamma, by gaining true understanding of the Dhamma, one is able to dry up and eventually cut off the stream of that craving and go beyond the here and the beyond, the dualities. Okay, the next verse, verse number 4. This verse deals with still another defilement. This is called conceit. Conceit in Pali is mana. And what is quite remarkable is the way the Buddha has selected these particular mental states that we usually take for granted and just assume that they're natural parts of human nature, parts of the human constitution, the human makeup. And he's shown that these are not necessary parts of the human mind, but these are just defilements or corruptions of the mind, which have extremely harmful effects upon ourselves and harmful effects for others. And he says that these are very basic mental factors that we really have to examine and understand, come to understand their nature, to see how they function within our own minds. And one of the most important of these is this factor, conceit. Now, when we hear the word conceit, it usually suggests to us the idea of thinking oneself to be better than others. But in the Buddha's teaching, there are three types of conceit, and all of them are equally important, equally fundamental. The word conceit in Pali, the word mana, comes from a verbal root ma, which means to measure. And so conceit itself suggests the idea of measuring oneself in comparison with others. And so when this measuring takes place, the results, the score, as you will, if you will, can come out in three ways. One way, the way we usually think of conceit, is the score of, you call it, the winning score. The superiority conceit. I am better. And so somebody who has this conceit goes about, often they become haughty, arrogant, scornful towards others, thinking, I am better, I am superior. But that's not the only type of conceit. There are still two other forms. One other type of conceit is just the diametrical opposite of the superiority conceit. That is the inferiority conceit. On the scorecard, it is the losing score. Which doesn't mean that one is actually lost, but it's just the subjective judgment. The feeling, I'm inferior, not as good as the other. And so this type of attitude makes one feel dejected, unhappy, grim, miserable, sometimes resentful, angry, bitter. And then the third type of conceit, the third score is, you might call it the tie score. That is, it's the conceit, the equality conceit. I am just as good as the other. And this is, maybe this type of conceit makes a person feel competitive. The type of, I have to compete. I have to show that I'm as good as the other. Of course, this doesn't mean when we speak about this as a conceit that we shouldn't make efforts to improve ourselves and to excel. The Buddha, in fact, encourages people should definitely make efforts to excel. But at the same time that we make the effort to excel, we should not grasp hold of our achievements and then use this as a basis for ranking ourselves as being higher or better than others. And the verse compares conceit to a fragile bamboo bridge. This is something one finds very often in the tropical countries. I know this from my experience in Sri Lanka. No doubt in India they have the same thing, where there's a little stream and two masses of land separated by that stream. To pass from one side, from one bank to the other, the villagers will take pieces of bamboo or other types of wood, tie them together with rope, and then make this bamboo bridge to connect the two banks. And the bridge is usually narrow so that only one person can walk across at a time. And here this image speaks about a flood coming, probably during the monsoon season, and sweeping away, demolishing that fragile bamboo bridge. And here one might think of this flood as being the work of insight wisdom. The insight wisdom which sees into the truth of things. The wonderful, remarkable truth that within ourselves, within all other beings, there is nothing that can really be identified as a truly existing I or self, but we are all just changing phenomena, arising and passing away, and all phenomena are not mine, not I, not myself. And when one gains this insight, this wisdom, when one contemplates everything inside and outside as being not mine, not I, not myself, then this whole structure of conceit, we could say one end of the bridge is the conceit, I am better. The other end of the bridge, the conceit, I am worse. The middle part of the bridge, the conceit, I am equal, I am just as good as. All of that is swept away, and what remains is freedom of mind, complete freedom from any standpoint of attachment to these destructive ranking ideas of being better, worse, or just as good as. And giving up these ideas is like a serpent shedding its worn-out skin. Okay, now we come to verse number 5. He who does not find core or substance in any of the realms of being, like flowers that are vainly sought in fig trees that bear none, such a monk gives up the here and the beyond, just as a serpent sheds its worn-out skin. Okay, this verse also, it has a story behind it. The story is told in the Sutta Nipata commentary. There was once a Brahmin who had a daughter who was of marriageable age, and she was going to be engaged to get married, and he was going to bring her to the house of her prospective husband for the engagement ceremony. And at that time it was customary for the father to bring a garland of flowers to the house of the prospective husband, and then the husband would take the garland of flowers and put it over the head of his prospective wife, and that would be a kind of symbol of their engagement. And now this Brahmin wanted to get to make a garland of flowers from using a type of flower that had never previously been used for an engagement garland before. And so he was wondering where he could find a flower that had never been used for that purpose before. And so he was wandering around. Then he saw a group of boys, it would have been like teenage boys, standing around. And he approached them and he asked them if they knew where he could find some flowers, a type of flower that had never been used for an engagement garland before. And when he said this, these boys sort of looked at each other, and maybe they sort of winked at each other and thought, let's play a trick on this Brahmin. Okay, and so the eldest in the group of boys said, well, you can get the fig tree flowers. They've never been used for a garland before. why don't you go to the, there's some fig trees down by the side of the river. Why don't you use those to make a garland? Okay, so the Brahmin went down to the river where the fig trees were growing. He climbed up one fig tree, looked all over the branches, couldn't find any flowers. Then he went to the next fig tree, climbed up, looked all over the branches, couldn't find any flowers. He spent the whole day going up one fig tree after another, couldn't find any flowers. Then he went to the other side of the river, started looking through all of the fig trees on that side of the river, couldn't find any flowers. Then there was a monk sitting under a tree on the other side of that river, meditating. And the monk saw the Brahmin going up one fig tree after another. And so the monk asked the Brahmin, "What are you doing?" And the Brahmin said, "I'm looking for some fig tree flowers." And then the monk said, "But you're looking for something that doesn't exist. There's no such thing as a fig tree flower, since fig trees don't bear flowers." And then when he said that, this is according to the commentary, the Buddha, through his power of hearing, supernormal power of hearing, was able to hear that conversation. And then the Buddha came to that monk and recited this verse: "He who does not find core or substance in any of the realms of being, like flowers that are vainly sought in fig trees that bear none, such a monk gives up the here and the beyond, just as a serpent sheds its worn-out skin." And when the Buddha recited this verse, on hearing it, the monk immediately, his mind became deeply concentrated. He started to gain insight knowledges one after another, and within seconds he achieved arahantship, and his mind was liberated from all obstacles. Okay, so what is meant by this statement that one does not find core or substance in any of the realms of being? Now, in the Buddha's teaching, we speak about existence or life as made up of many different realms of being. We think that this visible realm of being in which we're living now, this is the only real realm of existence, the only real realm of being. But in fact, we are a little bit like, there are types of microorganisms that grow up inside the stomach of a cow, and they think the stomach of the cow, that is the universe, and there's nothing outside the stomach of the cow. If somebody says that the stomach of the cow is only the organ inside a big organism called a cow, and that cow is only one cow in a whole herd of cows, and those cows are only one type of living organism on something called the earth, if somebody were to tell that microorganism this, that microorganism would say, "What are you saying, man? You've gone mad. I mean, let's be sensible. Let's speak about what we could touch, taste, pinch. That's real. That is what really exists. what we can pinch is the stomach of the cow, what we can touch is the stomach of the cow, what we can taste is the stomach of the cow. That is the universe. So don't tell me that the stomach of the cow is just something limited and that there are other things beyond the stomach of the cow. Don't tell me that there's a big cow and that the stomach of the cow is only something inside a big cow. And so we're very much in the same situation. This world that we're living in, we have world news. We think that what we hear on the world news is the news about everything that's going on in the universe. But in fact, there are many, many other realms of existence beyond our own that we can't see, extending much higher than our realm of existence, going much further below than our realm of existence. Realms of existence invisible to us. And in the Buddha's teaching, we find descriptions of many of these realms of existence. But what all of these realms of existence have in common is that life in all of these realms is impermanent and finite. So a living being will come into existence in one of these realms, depending upon its actions in previous lives, its karma, will live for a certain period of time within that realm, and then pass away and take rebirth elsewhere. And within any realm of existence, a living being will consist of a combination of factors of existence. These factors of existence, these are what we call the five aggregates. The five aggregates are bodily form, feeling, perception, mental formations, different volitions, desires, intentions, and so on, and consciousness. And the living being is just a combination of these five aggregates of existence, nothing more. These five aggregates exist united. They function together according to the law of conditionality. The five aggregates are always arising and passing away from moment to moment. Because they arise and pass away so quickly, they create the illusion, the appearance, that there's some kind of continuing entity, some kind of lasting substance. And we call that substance I, me, myself. Then we identify with that. And that becomes the center for our sense of personal identity, what I really am, what I truly am. But the five aggregates are always changing. There's nothing lasting in them, no substance, no essence. And the Buddha says when one examines these five aggregates very closely with the eye of wisdom, the eye of insight, one finds that they are all empty, hollow, without substance. He says that the aggregate of form of the body is like a lump of foam, K carried down by a river. If one sees a lump of foam carried down by a river, from a distance it looks solid. It looks like it might be even a granite, a mass of granite. But if one comes up to that mass of foam and strikes at it with a stick, one sees that it's just a lot of bubbles stuck together. And so the Buddha says, bodily form, physical form, is just like a lump of foam. And really, that statement seems to foreshadow the statements of modern physics. We say that in the atom, what is it but fields of electrons surrounding a nucleus, and the actual matter of the atom, well, the simile that I've read, it's like if we took a basketball and put it in the center of, say, a baseball field, Yankee Stadium, and then we had some baseball fans moving around, a few baseball fans moving around in the stands of Yankee Stadium. Okay, the basketball in the center would be like the matter and the nucleus of the atom. The fans moving around in the stands, just a few fans, a few hundred fans, those would be like the electrons moving around in the electron fields of the atom. And the rest of the atom is like the empty space between the stands and the basketball in the middle of the playing field. That's what the atom is like. And the body is made up all of atoms. So it's mostly empty space. Feeling, the Buddha says, is like a water bubble on the surface of a pond when it's raining. Drops of rain come down, and when they strike the pond, water bubbles come up, and then they burst. And so feelings arise, pleasant feelings, painful feelings, neutral feelings. They seem to be lasting, to be substantial, but when we look at them closely, the feelings are just momentary bursts of energy arising and passing. Perception is like a mirage, creates appearances of solidity. But those appearances, when we examine them close up, are false and deceptive. The volitions, the willing portion of the mind, is like the trunk of a banana tree. If you've ever seen the trunk of a banana tree, you can peel off one layer after another layer after another layer, thinking maybe when you peel off enough layers, finally you'll get to some solid hardwood in the middle of the trunk. But when you peel off one layer after another from the banana trunk, finally you peel off the last layer, and in the center, there's nothing. It's just empty. Just layers of tissue surrounding one, surrounding another. And consciousness, the awareness of everything that goes on in our experience, is like a magical illusion. A magician sets up a stand. He recites some mantras, he takes some stones and sticks, grass, puts it on the stand, recites some mantras, waves a wand over it, waves a cloth over it, hits it with a wand, and then an elephant appears, a little elephant or a little rabbit, a little duck, and everybody goes, ah! It's wonderful, marvelous, magnificent. But if you are standing behind the magician, you see that he's a trickster taking, not maybe the elephant doesn't work, but he's taking the little rabbit from the cage, quickly putting it behind the curtain, taking a little duck from behind the cage, putting it behind the curtain, quickly doing all this so quickly, nobody can see his hands moving. And everybody believes it's real magic. But because you can see behind the magician, you know it's just a deceptive, magical show. That is the working of consciousness. So all of this creating appearances of core or substance. But when one examines them closely, examines the body, examines feelings, examines perceptions, examines volitions, examines consciousness, one does not find any core or substance. And that discovery, that realization, brings, you could say, a disenchantment with the magical play of samsara, and leads to giving up the here and the beyond, just as a serpent sheds its worn-out skin. Okay, perhaps at this point I will stop the presentation for today. And then if there's any questions, then we can take some questions. Please feel welcome to ask, even those who are new, even basic questions. Yeah, please don't be shy.
I was wondering, you mentioned NA, measurement, and when speaking of perceived.
Yeah.
How are the children here taught? Is there a grading system? Or, and forgive me if it's a silly question, but we're new to this.
To my knowledge, there's no grading system here, but that's just because there's just a few children. Is Jane here? Yeah, she is the one who is in charge of the children's program.
Do the children from here measure themselves with other classmates? I was just curious.
I don't think so. But I don't think that's done as a matter of principle. I think just because there's not so many children in the children's class that they could have an actual grading system. Yeah. Any further questions? Any points? Anybody want to make any comments? Yeah.
I just have a comment on your discussion of verse 5. I thought it was very invaluable.
Mm. Oh, thank you. Yeah. Okay, if there's...
If there's no conceit, like in the example of the bridge, but there's no one end on the other end, there's no middle, does the mind still exist?
Definitely the mind still exists.
But what is the basis of the mind's existence if it doesn't exist based on conceit?
The mind doesn't need conceit in order to exist or function. Let's say that conceit, craving, all of these defilements are, maybe you call them parasites, which lodge themselves in the mind and exist off the mind. But these parasites can be cleared out and the mind will still function more radiantly, more freely than it can when the defilements are lodged in the mind.
So are you saying that without defilement there is a substantial existence called mind?
Not a substantial existence.
Is this still a conditional existence?
The mind is a conditioned existence.
Conditional what? If there is no conceit, if there is not a sense of I comparing to better or worse or equal to others, what is this mind? what is the condition for this mind to exist?
Let us say the Buddha, the Arahants, the liberated ones, their minds function, I mean, much more effectively, more freely than our minds function. So things like conceit are constrictions of the mind, limitations on the mind. Yet at the same time that mana means measurement, measurement also implies limitation. So they are things that limit the mind. So when they are eliminated, then the mind acquires a kind of limitless function, a free and limitless function. It's conditioned in that, okay, for the mind to function, first in our human existence, the mind needs a body to function. So it's conditioned by the body. It's still conditioned by our past, in that our past, say, habits and tendencies will still in some way persist, so that we still have basically the undefiled traits of character still persist in some way. So the person's personality doesn't completely and absolutely change when it's free from conceit. Though the conceited aspects of the personality will be eliminated. But there's still some, residual influence from the past. And then many conditioning factors, just as there are conditioning factors in the present. Just think of present moments when you've been free from, even momentarily free from conceit. Still the mind is able to function. And so if it's permanently free from conceit, also it can function with conditions. Yeah.
In these five verses you talked about today, every single example or the story behind the verses, the monk will become an arahant. So is it not a requirement to have some period of development between the attainment of stream entry to the time of full attainment of arahantship? Can a person or a practitioner just understand impermanence and then fairly quickly in meditation, in sitting, reach arahantship?
This is the way it's related in the stories. As I said, sometimes one has to be a little skeptical about some of these stories because they are always like the grand conclusion. But it is possible to go directly from the state of an unenlightened person to the state of arhatship. I think that in making that attainment, one would reach the other stages in quick succession. It wouldn't be that one jumps from the state of ordinary person to arahant immediately, but even while sitting there, the person will go through each of the three previous stages and then come out as arahant. But it's possible in real life that the person only achieved the stage of stream entry as a result of the Buddha's saying. And then as the story went on, it became transformed into an arhatship. Okay, then we will conclude. If there's no more questions, we'll conclude by sharing the merits. Okay, we share the merits from this discourse and from listening to the discourse. We share it with the devas, the deities, the Dhamma protecting spirits and with other beings. And today I especially want to share the merits also with Venerable Master Yinshun, who passed away in Taiwan last night. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Nagam Hidika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mangparang Etavatacham Hehi Sampadang Punyasampadang Sabe deva anumodantu Sabha sampati siddhya Etavata cham hehi sampadang punya sampadang Sabe bhuta anumodantu Sabha sampati siddhya Etavata cham hehi sampadang punya sampadang Sabe sata anumodantu Sabha sampati siddhya.